premiering tonight. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Puberty is when you grow into your adult body, usually between 8 and 14 years old. All that growing brings changes that may make you feel scared, confused, excited, or all of the above. It's all good. You're just maturing. Puberty is a process that lasts years, hits differently for everybody, and can last till you're around 20. So how do the changes show up? You may get pimples, mostly on your face, but on your body too. Hair. The hair you have on your arms and legs may get thicker and darker, and you'll likely grow hair in new places, like your face, armpits, chest, and pubic area. Stretch marks are common too, a sign of your adult body taking shape. Physical changes, from body odor to growth spurts, are just part of the puberty story. All kinds of new feelings may come on too, like crushes and being sexually turned on. It's super common to feel like your emotions suddenly turn on and off, sad, angry, or irritated. No matter how you're feeling about all these changes to your body, remember that puberty is a normal part of growing up, and knowing what to expect can help to make it feel a lot less weird or stressful. Want to learn more? Go to PlannedParenthood.org/teens.
And you're listening to radio station WUSB in Stony Brook. We're broadcasting at 90.1 FM, 107.3 FM, and to the entire world via the internet on WUSB.FM. Take your pick of how you want to listen to us. It's 6 o'clock on a Tuesday. Time once again for Off the Wall. And a very good evening to everybody. The program is Off the Wall. Emmanuel Goldstein over here. Kyle over there.
Hi, everyone.
And it's been another one of those weeks, hasn't it? And by a week, I mean since the last time we spoke. Obviously, it's only Tuesday, so not much of a week yet, but still an awful lot is going on in the world and in this country.
Well, a lot's happening on weekends, too.
That's true as well.
Both in the streets, but also some of the stuff that's just done quietly or rapidly, so to speak, after hours. You could even say that about markets, too, these days. Like with the tariff negotiations and stuff. Worldwide, many markets and measures of market growth or lack thereof are done outside of regular trading hours. I think bonds are like that, too, or futures as well.
I don't know. Yeah, I don't understand any of it, to be honest.
No, I'm not saying that's important.
But no, I've taken to watching, in the middle of the night, this channel called CNBC World, which is different from CNBC. You know, you'll get reality shows and stupid programming overnight in America. But in other countries, you get the World Channel. And what they do is they give you live reports from different markets as they open. So Asia, Singapore, Europe, and then eventually the United States, where it broadcasts the same thing that they do here. But it's just kind of fascinating to see that when there's a crisis.
Yes, it was our gift to the world through globalization that we would all have markets.
Uh-huh, yeah. But anyway, that was last week, the panic of the markets. Things seem to have calmed down. Not that it means anything to any of us.
It's an indicator.
Well, I don't know what's an indicator of.
It's a red flag.
Yeah, it's just one of the indicators, but it doesn't really affect our daily lives. The price of things and the overall challenge of just getting through a month, that's of more importance to the average person.
But it does impact people's overall worth. Many Americans' wealth is tied up in these markets. I don't know. We're not dismissing it, but it isn't the most pressing issue day to day.
No.
Correct, yeah.
I couldn't care less what the Dow Jones average is. I don't even know what that means, to be honest. It's a number. It's a number that goes up, number that goes down. The number in my bank account, that's the number that affects me, you know, and, you know, paychecks, things like that, the rate of inflation.
Median income, that's important to me.
Absolutely.
Because most places, median income are well above what the average person can accrue annually, and I find that galling.
Mm-hmm. And what you have to remember is that the people in power now really aren't affected by the things that affect us. They're way above this. You know, they have their billions of dollars to mess with, and they basically have a totally different set of values, and they are not connected to us. And this is true.
Oh, but they are. They want to project those values onto us, whether we like it or not, well, and troll us in the process.
Of course, yeah, but that doesn't do us any good at all.
Never.
Yeah.
Sorry to interrupt. I can't help myself.
No, it's all right. There's a lot of interrupting going on in this regime that we have running our country right now. But we need that. We need more interrupting. We need more resistance. We need more disruption.
I saw some town halls.
Yeah, you know, what was it, Chuck Grassley today?
Yeah, he was.
Did you see how close people were getting to him? It was basically one head length away. Somebody was asking a very pointed question of him. I don't know if it was because he could barely hear the person. Or what, if it's just a very intimate Iowa crowd there, but it was something to see. It's on C-SPAN if you haven't seen it.
People should be in politicians' faces more frequently,
absolutely.
Especially at town halls where it's controlled in that setting. But one thing I observed in the way people speak is how closely, seemingly divergent points of view were to my own opinions about the current state of things. People that are talking about issues I don't necessarily have a lot of interest in, but they're talking about it and framing it, putting it to this politician in the context of rights and our freedoms and our, you know, very similarly to what I might talk about as far as, you know, a freedom of religion or ability to assemble and protest. The very same concerns are being put forth, albeit for over different issues and reasons. That, to me, was very interesting because people are upset regardless mm-hmm. whether they voted for this, they have buyer's remorse, or, you know, there are occasional people that are cheerleading and saying, I'm so happy with everything, that's great. But there's a lot of alignment, I would say, that is unexpected, or I guess we could have predicted, but it's aligning much more quickly than I thought. People are pretty disturbed, shall I say.
And this goes across the political spectrum, Republican, Democrat. I think a lot of people are very uneasy with what's going on, and that's why we have to work together. We can't just simply dismiss people because they're of a different party or believe in different things. If we're concerned about where the country is heading right now, we need to work together. There's just no other way that you can possibly affect change. So, you know, I hope to see more of that. You know, watching these town halls, what few there are, I'm very impressed by how well-informed people are, how they are able to articulate and just stand up for what they believe in. I really, even when I disagree with somebody, I respect them if they can do that.
There was a guy who was standing there. He had like a little printed book report. Basically, he typed up his statements, which felt a little stilted. But if you're not familiar with public speaking, that is a good thing to do, is just read what you had prepared. He's talking about some guy on YouTube, something related to guns, that had just provided a diagram and been talking about it, and he got hauled away in Wisconsin. And he's worried about that kind of dragnet coming to Ohio. That was his issue.
Okay.
And in a lot of regards, I could say, like, okay, come on, what is this? Like some ghost gun guy on YouTube trying to get grade school kids, you know, building guns or something. I don't know. I mean, I know that's an exaggeration and hyperbole, but point is, I don't really have as much interest in that particular political prisoner in Wisconsin that he's advocating for, like, you know, alarm about those kinds of heavy-handed tactics. But I do think people that are recording themselves on YouTube and not, as he said, promoting any kind of violence, simply sharing ideas or designs or drawing a picture, as he stated, of a particular piece of metal. You know, he's using very benign, vague language because it is related to firearms. But in my opinion, you know, that is a right we should have, is to share information. That's very much aligned with what we talk about with technology and security and breaking technology. They're just ideas, and you can't be criminalized just for sharing about that. Another woman was talking about her family farm, a very small farm that raises horses. I believe they were miniature horses, and she was really concerned about spraying, chemical spraying,
okay,
by perhaps a large agri business. And I mean, maybe I have interests in the chemical industry. Maybe all that aside, I don't want, I want those interests to be wholly thwarted in favor of protecting people who have small farms. So, I mean, if you're, even if you're diehard for agribusiness, it's not fair to be killing horses that are your neighbors. And she was talking about basically when 70-mile-an-hour winds are occurring, there should not be chemical spraying. And it's going on. She's had multiple horses die, and she's upset. Why is no one, why isn't the law being enforced? She's observed this behavior. It's corporate abuse of their power and influence, and she's trying to stick up for herself, saying this is wrong. And like, I fully support that. Maybe I don't have as much interest in her particular farm or miniature horses or something, but I do think she has an absolute rock solid point. Do not be abused by these large entities. That to me, it has many parallels. If I'm interested in vehicles or if I'm interested in other products, the same kind of abuses occur. So we're all kind of in it together.
Yeah, it's that might not be my main issue. I might be more concerned with what's going on with humans and how they're being mistreated. But, yeah, I respect those concerns as well. And we have to listen to those concerns. And the politicians certainly need to listen to those concerns. It's all related. It's all together, and we need to work together to be listened to. It's super important.
People shouldn't feel powerless.
Mm-hmm.
That's why those leaders, senators, and representatives need to be available and
right.
accessible.
Now, locally, if you want to address your thoughts and opinions, concerns to our local representative, Nick LaLota, that's the sound you'll hear. Nothing. There is no option. You can't talk to him. You just can't do it. You can't do it. They'll hold a Soviet-style, quote-unquote, town hall that is remote, digital, you know, that maybe you can connect to. You won't be able to speak. You won't be able to ask a question. Oh, sure, they'll say this is a question from the audience, but it's pre-selected. It's you know, edited down. It's not your concern. You will not have that ability. This is what people here in the first district of Long Island of the House of Representatives voted for. And this, unfortunately, is what you wind up with. No representation at all. And it's like you don't exist. At least, you know, those town halls in other parts of the country, they might be a bit chaotic and noisy, but the voices are being heard. And, you know, no matter how cagey the politicians happen to be, I still have to give them credit for at least showing up, even if they duck out almost immediately. It's something. It's some kind of responsibility that is being displayed, as opposed to nothing here. Absolutely nothing. And, you know, I don't know what to say other than stop voting for this kind of thing. I mean, every time we vote for somebody who doesn't respect us, we can't be outraged when they do that, when they don't respect us, when they don't have town halls, when they don't answer our questions or address our concerns. It's super important that we think carefully, because we might get somebody that doesn't completely represent us, but at least we'll get somebody who will listen to us and engage with us. And that is what it's all about.
I voted.
Just now?
I did. Do you want to know what it's about?
You get to vote more times, I think,
okay,
than I voted in my entire
right.
life in
I
one
get
year.
To vote. I vote when I want. All right. I know we have other things to talk about, but I actually, I don't know how, I was conflicted about this. I didn't really have a voter guide from the stranger, you know, any kind of...
Hang on. You gotta cite your terms when you
liberal newspapers that are touting their opinions about things
in Seattle. Now you are a Washington native, and you get to vote even when you're not in Washington State because of this amazing vote by mail system that everybody in Washington State uses. You can be somewhere else; they will find you. Well, you tell them where you are, and they send you a ballot. And it's all very secure. You sign your name, they match
yeah.
the signature and all that kind of thing.
They know that.
And you get so many ballots. You get so many propositions that are on the ballot. It's really amazing. I am envious.
Yes. A lot of people travel for work. You don't have to just be a journalist. You can be a fuller brush salesman.
Yeah.
You know, door to door.
One of those came around
yeah.
last week. They are aggressive.
Uh-huh. Ooh. Yeah, you could, you know, be an Avon employee, whatever. Point is, I had a little bit of time left to get my ballot in. I read an article in the Seattle Times today, which was about this issue. I voted for fingerprints.
Okay, you're going to have to explain what that means.
So basically, I mean, I'm not a big property baron. I was just talking about median income. And this doesn't really bother me that much because it's basically extending the AFIS system, which is the automated fingerprint identification system, which is operated in King County. And it's actually a pretty outstanding, highly capable fingerprint system in King County. And, I mean, I was a little conflicted thinking about this. I was like, I don't really know how I feel about this. Like, I'm not going to be bearing as much of the cost. It's a 6-year extension. It's a fraction of a penny for every $1,000 assessed on your property. Whatever. Fine. Increase the taxes. But basically, it is to support this countywide system that operates massive databases of fingerprints.
Uh-huh.
So I'm thinking to myself, like, well, is there something about this I can't get behind? And I honestly couldn't think of anything.
Well, I'm a little curious here. What this means? What fingerprints? Everyone's fingerprints? Whose fingerprints?
Well, that's good that you asked that. It's a database that's built mainly on people that are booked into jail. So criminals that are fingerprinted.
Alleged criminals, Kyle.
Right.
Haven't had their day in court yet. I know that's not a thing anymore, but they are entitled to representation.
You can take as long as you want on my issue.
No, I just want to make sure that...
I know you have other things you want to talk about. I can't tell you every detail of this. I'm trying to just paraphrase. But I voted for it.
But what did you vote for exactly?
To basically support this system to continue... This automated fingerprinting system, because otherwise it would fall on what is otherwise the state level FBI, which in Washington is the Washington State Patrol. Here in New York, it is the New York Highway Patrol. They manage most of the investigations and fingerprinting at a higher level than like your average county or local police department.
So what's
right?
the advantage of voting for what you voted for as opposed to having it go to the state?
The expertise and this system, which has a lot of employees, they employ a lot of different technologies. It basically makes it easier to search fingerprints quickly and extensively.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a technology that, like, I'm aware of. It's not DNA, but it is actually a really huge tool in solving crimes. And part of me is like, well, this is, you know, how is this invasive? How is this that? And then the other thing, it's just getting too good. You can, you know, basically you can't do anything without worrying about getting caught. Apparently it's so good. If you cup your hands like a prowler, like putting your hands on a window,
mm-hmm.
the sides of your palms can be compared with a database of palm prints and possibly matched.
Side palm prints?
Yes. Yeah, so like if you're prowling vehicles and you put your hands up to a car window, those side prints on your palms could be compared to the database. That kind of stuff. So it's like...
This is why you wear gloves.
It's laid out. No, I know. That's the other thing. Everything I could think of, I was like, well... I guess I'd be wearing gloves for DNA anyway, so...
I'm not tipping them off. I'm not tipping off... No, hold on.
If you're going to do crimes...
I am not tipping off prowlers.
This is not the do crime
show. Before
that
gets started. No, this is common sense. Wear gloves.
No,
you're going to break into something.
I've seen Mr. Robot. I know what you got to do.
Uh-huh.
But the side of it that I thought was interesting is there was a story also in the Times article I read that was Seattle Times article that I read... that talked about someone who had been injured or was basically near death, and their family was notified because they had fingerprinted them, and they were able to make peace with them before they passed in the hospital from an accident. Stuff like that. That's pretty tragic. But
that was because they were already in the database because they were accused of a crime?
More or less, yeah. There's also... other sources for these fingerprints. But the more I thought about it, I was like, you know, if I'm on the side of being a victim, I want the best tools available.
Okay.
If something happens and fingerprints are going to help resolve something, I don't want some crack Keystone Cops team badly collecting fingerprints. I want the best tools available so that I can seek justice for whatever transgression has been waged against me. And I'll have to put my criming aspirations to the side. Not that I have any. But anyway, that was one thing that I voted for today.
So can I ask, The Stranger, which is an awesome publication, and everybody should read it, I think, they give all kinds of voting recommendations. Did they recommend voting for this?
They didn't say anything about it.
Oh.
And I don't think they are. I was looking to them, but honestly, I was looking for any kind of information. Like, is anybody talking about this upcoming election? Because it's the only thing on the ballot is should you renew 6 years? And basically, if it doesn't get renewed, they're not going to have funding or not going to be able to centralize this function in the county. And mm-hmm. it will fall onto places like the State Patrol, which will then lead to really large backlogs and other local departments that do not have the expertise. This the AFIS organization has mobile teams. This is also pointed out in the Times article I read. So anyway, be aware of the state of fingerprinting. It's still good. It's always been good, but it's better than ever, and people are voting for it. So I don't know if that's the, like, let's say, left of center attitude. If somehow fingerprints are a violation of some democratic point of view, but I think I, for the first time in a while, just thought about it in practical terms and was able to come to my own conclusion without any other than just reading like an article and kind of coming to my own conclusion, which was refreshing because I feel like a lot of people have been influenced a lot lately. And I mean, the cut and dry versions of things and the hyperbole around a lot of these elections has got to go. Like, mm-hmm. people have to have just the facts and they have to be able to think about them in earnest, you know, without a lot of, I guess, influence.
And when is this election?
22nd.
Of April.
Yeah.
Okay, so we'll be sure to report on the results to see if the referendum you voted for is
I don't know. Yeah. Passes.
And you say this is the only thing?
Maybe I went against
this is the only thing on the ballot, that one referendum?
The one thing on the ballot. That's why I was, like, wow. kind of amazed. Why isn't anyone writing about this? The Times did put an article out today, the Seattle Times. So read that article, vote with your conscience. And yeah, I may have voted against my liberal attitudes, but I don't think I did.
You know, the voting record of this country, even if you make a mistake and vote for the wrong thing, you're entitled after the massive mistakes that have already been made here. So
I guess that's why I'm telling you. I'm putting it out there. I'm saying, hey, look, I just voted for something that is about crime fighting.
Mm-hmm.
There.
Yeah.
And if that's a far conservative view, then you know what? I'm going to have to own it.
Yeah.
And I'm admitting it publicly.
See, that takes courage.
Yeah.
I want to talk about courage.
Let's hear about
nice
it.
Nice transition here.
I'm down.
Okay, so you know how everybody is caving to Trump, whether it's legal firms, whether it's high-tech companies, whether it's just average people, billionaires, you name it, all these people and entities, Columbia University, another great example, just basically bowing down and doing whatever Trump says and losing a whole lot of respect in the process. You know, we have talked on this show a lot about the need for people to stand up against what is going on because it is so harmful. It is so tragic to what this nation stands for. And this past week, one of the most historic is a good word for it, institutions in this country. I'm talking about a university that was founded in, do you want to guess at the year, Kyle?
1820.
Try 1636.
Ooh.
Before this damn country even existed, Harvard University was founded. I mean, you know, you can have whatever thought you want about Harvard University, but you gotta respect that. They've been around for almost 400 years. That's like British style history there. I mean, it's incredible. Anyway, they basically were being threatened, as many universities have been threatened, with having all federal funds completely cut off unless they bend the knee and do what Trump says. And there are a number of demands there relating to DEI, relating to how students are treated if they protest against something, hiring practices, basically all sorts of things. Harvard University was faced with a loss of over $2 billion over the course of a few years from the federal government in endowments and grants and things like that. On Friday, the government quietly sent Harvard a new, more detailed list of orders. 3 days later, the university president named Alan Garber, class of 76, delivered a scathing rejection of what he described as unprecedented demands being made by the federal government to control the Harvard community. I'm reading from the Harvard Crimson, which is the student newspaper of Harvard University. It was founded in 1873. It's about as old as the New York Times. That kind of thing just really, it blows me away. The Starbucks on campus was founded in 1902.
That's not true.
All right, I made...
Starbucks didn't exist till the 70s.
I have a history of making one of three things up. Okay, so that was that. But still, it probably, whatever they do have there is probably really, really old. Anyway, so yeah, a scathing rebuke. I mean, I just love the sound of that. Now, it's not clear if that new letter on Friday prompted Harvard's shift from embracing cautious dialogue with Trump to this outright rejection. But the new demands show how deeply Trump and his administration aim to shape the inner workings of Harvard. When the university publicly released a memo listing the new demands on Monday, they drew instant backlash from academics who described them as unacceptable and counter to decades-long traditions of academic freedom. Former Harvard Medical School Dean Jeffrey Flier said in an interview that if the university had acceded to the demands, it would have marked the end of Harvard as an independent institution. It was overwhelmingly overreaching any reasonable level of interest in seeing Harvard change. Government professor Stephen Levitsky wrote in a text message that the new demands were impossible to accept. It would have been the end of Harvard, a death blow to academic freedom.
Yeah, what I heard, it was basically what amounted to government takeover of that institution.
Exactly.
With all the, I guess they're talking about monitoring and doing some sort of reporting about your compliance with God knows what, I guess all the DEI stuff they're so scared of. It was just so far reaching that it would have basically hollowed out the sort of staid, wise independence that you would expect a place with such a tradition. And I think they should reject the money and school this government on exactly what it means to be independent.
The thing is, $2 billion, Carl. That's a
who cares?
That's a chunk of change.
That's
exactly.
Nothing.
The thing is, had they agreed to this, it would have been so much more expensive because they would have lost their institution. They absolutely would have lost it. Harvard would not have survived. $2 billion, yeah, that's a blow. But, you didn't have $2 billion 100 years ago or 200 years ago or 300 years ago, and you built this incredible university. It's not about the money. It shouldn't be about the money.
Their endowment and alumni network could probably raise multiple times that in less than a year.
Wouldn't that be something?
I think the respect and the exercise, the exercise for Harvard Law School to fight this, the exercise,
yes,
the exercise in truly being independent is worth so much more than that.
In Trump's letter, he specifically instructed Harvard to begin reducing the power held by tenured and untenured faculty and administrators who are, quote, more committed to activism than scholarship. Now, the letter didn't define what it would mean to prioritize activism over scholarship, but many faculty have participated in anti-Trump demonstrations, and a contingent of professors led the most vocal push for Harvard to resist federal demands. He would want to forbid all of that. The letter's language also seemed to invoke the argument embraced by conservatives that some academic disciplines, particularly fields that study race, gender, and sexuality, are activism and not scholarship. You know, these people don't know the first thing about academia, about higher education. You know, they think education, they think science, they think all that is the enemy. They are ignorant. They are bullies. And it's just great to see somebody finally stand up against them. Yeah, it'll be costly for a little bit, but Trump isn't going to be around forever. And the more people and the more institutions that do this, the less time we'll have to deal with this. Now, the Trump administration also demanded that Harvard commission a third party to audit programs that contribute to anti-Semitism or reflect ideological capture, whatever that means. The White House demanded audits of entire schools, including the Harvard Graduate School of Education, the Divinity School, the School of Public Health, and the Medical School. I mean, that tells you something right there. And, you know, speaking to the issue of anti-Semitism, of course, any institution has an interest in battling that. But you can't simply say that if you demonstrate for Palestinian statehood or for the end to the bombing of the Gaza, that does not make you anti-Semitic. In Trump land, it does. In Trump land, they are taking people who participated in a demonstration and deporting them, sending them, and in some cases, sending them to a prison in El Salvador. And, you know, moving away from Harvard for a second, you know, this was the week that I think a lot of the media finally woke up. We've been talking about this for weeks, about how people are being sent to El Salvador, and they are immigrants, but the Trump administration has been coyly hinting that they would like to expand this. So that's not just people without U.S. citizenship or people who aren't born here, but it's everybody, everybody. So this week, Trump basically said that he would like to build more prisons in El Salvador.
Yeah, it's like it's going to be our Siberia.
I don't think he said it quite like that, but he did say it with the dictator of El Salvador standing by his side. And yes, that guy is a dictator. Okay, he looks attractive, which makes him acceptable to many people, apparently. That's the low bar that we have. But he is a dictator. He is a horrible person. It's a horrible regime. And it's basically a concentration camp that people are being moved into. And the fact that our country, mistakenly, by all accounts, sent somebody there and is refusing a unanimous Supreme Court ruling, in fact, to bring him back. That speaks such volumes. It'll deafen you. It's disgusting. The Supreme Court clearly said, facilitate the return of this person who was sent there by mistake. Was not a part of a gang, was not a terrorist, was here legally, did everything right, has a family, was sent there by mistake, and admittedly by mistake. And to have the dictator of El Salvador come to Washington, D.C. and say, well, I'm not going to send him back because he's a terrorist, and have, you know, Trump do his just nodding by his side and saying, yeah, he's a terrorist, even though there's absolutely no evidence of anything like that. He was never accused of that. It's disgusting. That is what our country has become, where you just defy the law. It is the law. When the Supreme Court tells you to do something and it's unanimous, you can't get any more law than that. And Trump is just saying, nope, not going to do it. Not going to obey you. Not going to even admit that we did anything wrong.
They'll keep saying that until they have actual Americans fleeing El Salvador, making the trip and trying to cross the border. They're no longer illegal immigrants at the border in Texas or Mexico. It'll be actual American citizens trying to get back into the country to flee where they've been sent illegally.
Now, you know, a lot of legal scholars have weighed in on this since yesterday, when this was said pretty blatantly, saying that, yeah, it's not constitutional, it's not legal. Guys, wake up. He doesn't care about that. They don't care about that. They think they're above the law. No matter what is said, they intend to do it their way. What are you going to do about that? What is the plan? You know, I don't think the Supreme Court has a plan. What happens if you make a ruling and the executive branch refuses to follow that ruling? What do you do? What is the plan? We need to answer these questions. This is a constitutional crisis. There is no question anymore. What is the plan for when somebody who feels they're above the law, and we certainly have given him all the ammunition he needs to believe that by charging him with multiple crimes from multiple jurisdictions and then just making it all go away because he was elected again. That guy feels like he can do whatever he wants, and that is exactly what's going on right now. So until more of us start acting like Harvard, and saying, no, we're not doing this. Even if it costs us, we're not doing this.
The answer is resist and revolt. Uh-huh. And I am saying revolution. This that's what happens. That's what you do. When there is no recourse, what's left? I'm not going to imply anything, not going to, like, try to give people ideas, but, yeah, don't give them an inch. We said that at the beginning of this administration, that going and visiting with him and trying to be in good favor and bending the hips to him, like, I'm sorry, you're not going to get anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't think better of you when you do that. So resisting by every means possible is one. And revolting, that's protest. Because you know what? I would just say he views activism as anything but being a prisoner to their authoritarian whims. Like if you don't act as a prisoner to it and submit, he finds that to be activism, whether you speak about it, whether you reject it, any kind of anything counter to their worldview is considered some anomalous thing that should be eliminated or taken out of view. That's not how our system works, and yet it's being quickly reframed as anathema to what his sense of America is. And I think even the people that put him there are realizing, wow, like, I don't have the freedom I think I did under this guy. And long story long, like, if they act with impunity and there is actually no recourse, no penalty and justice on behalf of people and no action in Congress, you get revolt. That's it. Straight up. I don't need to tell you what that is, but that's what happens.
Well, the thing about revolution is it's subjective. You know, to Trump, simply saying no is revolution, and it must be stamped out. And that's true of any dictator. Lukashenko will do the same thing. Putin would certainly do the same thing. Tons of them all around the world would do the same thing. Any kind of dissent is basically seen as unpatriotic, whereas my view, certainly, and I believe your view, Kyle, is that dissent is the most patriotic thing you can do at this point, because otherwise you're just following blindly and going against everything that this country is alleged to stand for and basically just not following the rule of law, not having any respect for institutions, throwing aside all of our allies and trade partners, and basically making life a living hell for everybody in this country at one point or another. It might affect you later than others. Others are being affected right now. People are living in fear. People are afraid to do all kinds of things. People are afraid to express an opinion. People are afraid to write a letter to the editor. People are afraid to say something in a coffee shop. This is America? This is the country that I grew up in? No, this is not the Soviet Union. This is not how things are supposed to be. Absolutely not.
I'm talking mass boycotts, doing things that give them nothing. I think that is what it is. And people have a lot, and being able to assemble and say what you want to say. I'm not talking about storm the Capitol. I'm talking about assembling.
No, that's their thing.
That's their thing.
Yeah.
And that's apparently okay.
Well, it depends. For them, it's okay. You know, I have to give the right in this country credit for standing up for what they believe in and being loud and obnoxious about it. We need to do the same thing on the left. Need to do the same thing on the left because we are too reserved, too polite. I mean, you know, think of Chuck Schumer. That is not the face of the opposition. Absolutely not. You need people to be in their face. You need people to disrupt. Think of all the times that Kamala Harris had her speeches interrupted by demonstrators of one sort or another, which is fine, but these demonstrators never did that to Trump, and they still don't. They need to do this.
That's got to change. In fact, a lot of the photo ops and his let's see, keeping up appearances need to be disrupted. Mm-hmm. It should just not be easy to paint this picture of his utopia. It should be, there should be problems.
And not just for him, for all of his underlings, but people who stand for him and just regurgitate what he says.
But the people have a lot to say, and they are assembling and getting practiced at it. There were thousands, 30,000 in L.A. to listen to Bernie.
Yeah, that was something.
I mean,
every day there needs to be something like that.
When 100,000 people are in front of the White House, that's revolt.
Yeah.
I mean, that is assembling, and that's what you were predicting. Like, this happens at the drop of a dime in other countries. People are getting good at this.
The thing is, and we have to realize that, and we have to be willing to do this. Every time you have an action like that, there is a price to pay. There is a price to pay. And I know it sucks. I know it's not something we all want to do. But, I mean, Harvard University could lose $2 billion in grants. That's their price. Us showing up and making our voices heard, you know, we don't know what the price will be. We could lose employment. We could be targeted by their Gestapo. They could spray water cannons at us. I don't know what the price will be. But the price of not doing something is far more. You know, you might not see it right away, but you will feel it when the things that we've come to depend upon are no longer there and no longer expected to be there.
But that's why it has to be as small and organic and local and disparate as it has been, because it has to grow and be something people are practiced mm-hmm. at.
Right.
There's, when that happens in other countries, those people know how to show up quickly, assemble, voice their opinions, and get home.
Mm-hmm.
It's not, again, not, we said it over and over again, we're not that practiced at it. Because we've lived in relative comfort with a relative, however dilapidated, relatively functional government. But when it is not functioning, you have to change the way you work and voice that. And I think that an assembly like that in Washington, like Million Man March, like all the large actions ever have been in our history, have to be the end stage. They have to be the last action before something really changes. And so I'm thinking it's mostly through these smaller things that will emerge and grow and have people hone the message, hone what they want to say, find common cause. And through that, over time, it's not something that happens overnight. So we have to continue to put the pressure on and give them nothing. Give them nothing to go and spray you with water cannons for. Nothing.
Now, of course, this affects people all over the country, the things that are happening. What's happening to students that are in this country on visas who make the mistake of expressing an opinion or being at a demonstration. We're not talking about people who are violent, people who threaten others. When there is evidence of that, you know, there is no sympathy for that kind of a thing. We're not talking about that at all. Look, Kyle and I visited the camp that the pro-Palestinian demonstrators had last spring at Stony Brook, and it was really incredible. It was very uplifting and a positive thing. So, you know, I saw no indication of anything violent or hostile in any way until the cops moved in and cleared everybody out, which was a disgrace, I think, and one of the reasons why we no longer have the same president of the university. At least that's what I choose to believe. But now 11 Stony Brook students have had their student visas revoked, no reason given. I want to read you something from the provost office that came out today here at Stony Brook. We shared with you last week that student visas were revoked for 11 Stony Brook students and their immigration records were terminated in the Student Exchange and Visitor Information System, known as CVIS. Our top priority last week was to inform the community of this action and to assure you that our Office of Global Affairs team has been working individually with each affected student. Those are important words. They're working with each affected student. Other places aren't so sympathetic. To date, there have been no additional terminations. Since we sent that message, we have received many inquiries from our community seeking additional detail on what this action means for these students, as well as a general desire to know how to help students in these situations. And again, that is awesome that that's what the community is concerned with, is helping these students. Not tracking them down, not getting them out of the country, not accusing them of things and forcing them to go away. No, how do we help them? That's what it's all about. We appreciate the care and concern so many in our Stony Brook community have voiced. And in this message, we will share a few additional details in response to your questions. First and foremost, we are taking every effort to protect the identities of each student in this situation. This limits the degree of detail we can share about individual cases, and to some extent, this group as a whole. Our affected students are not required to or expected to disclose their status to anyone, and we are upholding our responsibility to ensure their personal information remains as private as possible so they cannot be identified publicly. So important. That said, we can answer general questions about how we can and do support any student whose immigration status is revoked. We will work with all impacted students to support them in completing their academic course of study. The academic records of these students have not been affected and remain complete and intact. Students retain the opportunity to access their transcripts no matter their status. Students whose SEVIS status is terminated are no longer able to work. Graduate tuition scholarships remain in effect, but employment income is no longer allowed. This results in challenges to afford housing and other basic needs such as food. In cases where a student is in on-campus housing and has lost graduate stipend employment, Global Affairs, the graduate school, and the provost office are partnering with Student Affairs to support their housing needs. Of note, graduate students are eligible for summer housing and have 10-month or 12-month rental options. For basic needs, students can request funding from the Student Emergency Support Fund, managed by the Student Support Team. This fund provides emergency funding to help students afford essentials, including housing and food. The State University of New York has encouraged students to call the New York State Office for New Americans. That hotline is at 1-800-566-7636 for referrals to free legal help and programs. Now, anyone can donate to the Student Emergency Support Fund. Please note this is not a fund to support students' legal costs, but this fund can help impacted students cover critical needs such as housing, food, and other living expenses. Donations to this fund can support these affected students, as well as any other Stony Brook student in need. Any employee who is approached, this is important, any employee who is approached to provide personal information about a student's or colleague's status to outside law enforcement should not do so. That's right. If you are approached by outside law enforcement to provide personal information about a Stony Brook student, do not do so. Do not cooperate. This is coming from the university. This guidance has been in place since the beginning of the semester and continues to be our directive. Anyone who is asked to provide such information should contact university police and or general counsel, who can work with outside law enforcement with the primary goal of protecting students to the fullest extent possible. The Office of Global Affairs team is on call around the clock supporting students and can be easily reached at globalaffairs@stonybrook.edu to work with any faculty or staff who have questions. Do not hesitate to refer students, faculty, and staff to the Visa and Immigration Services and International Student Success offices. Thank you for your continued support and concern for our community of international scholars. I am just blown away by the respect with which these people are being treated by our university. I mean, just calling them scholars, you know, that's more than Columbia University has ever done. They couldn't move quickly enough to kick them off campus and to treat them like criminals and to let Adams and his goons in and basically kicked them out of dormitories and things like that. This was signed by Carl Lejeune, Executive Vice President for Academic Affairs and Provost, Celia Marshick, Vice Provost for Graduate Education, Dean of the Graduate School, and Lindsay Walker, Senior Associate Provost for Global Affairs. I swear I have never been prouder to have gone to Stony Brook and just to have been a part of this community for so long. This is what it's all about. This is what academia is all about. This is what democracy is all about. You stand up to injustice, and sometimes it's costly. Sometimes it's inconvenient. But you're doing the right thing for so many people who don't have any other options and are good people who will become great people with the right kind of backing. And I wish we could all learn that lesson. You know, Stony Brook, Harvard, we're taking good steps. We're taking good steps. It's going to be painful. It's going to be hard. But we are going to come out so much better as a result of this kind of attitude, as opposed to the hatred and ignorance that we see every day coming out of D.C. So,
yeah, do not become a tripwire for that hatred. And I would agree. We both attended some really cool institutions. We are affiliated with some really, really worthy institutions. I'm not entirely sure about where I went to school, but I feel like I would hear about it if they were acquiescing to this. And as such, as so far, I haven't heard anything like that.
Well, you know, I have to say, I've seen a lot of really good things coming out of New York. And I'm not putting us ahead of any other state, but, you know, a lot of states do bow down to Trump much quicker than they should. In New York, we're basically saying, no, we're not going to do that. We're going to keep our DEI programs in New York public schools. We are, you know, not going to do what you demand, and we will work as a state if we have to without federal support. You may disagree with who's in power now in certain areas, but on this, I think we have to stay united because, you know, the alternative to that is just, it's so costly. It's just not something that we should ever consider. Today, a federal judge rebuked the Trump administration for doing nothing to arrange the return of a Maryland man who was wrongly flown to a prison in El Salvador last month. In a hearing today, set in motion a process to determine if the Trump administration officials had defied court orders requiring the government to bring the man, Kilmer Garcia, back to the United States. That happened today. It needs to continue. We can't just keep deferring to Trump and letting him get away with all these things. Leaving out what she describes as a tight timeline, Judge Ginnis asked Abrego Garcia's lawyers to get their questions for the government ready by tomorrow. She says the plaintiffs can submit up to 15 questions and 15 requests for documents. The judge also says the plaintiffs can depose up to 6 administration officials, naming a few of them, Robert Cerna, top official at U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, and Joseph Mazzara, the acting general counsel of the Department of Homeland Security. Suggesting how expeditiously she intends to move, Judge Ginnis tells Drew Ensign, the Justice Department lawyer, that he should clear his calendar in order to arrange the discovery information she intends to request. She said, cancel vacation. Cancel other appointments. I'm usually pretty good about this in my courtroom, but not this time. Thank you. Thank you for that. We have so many battlegrounds that are in play right now. We need to pay attention to all of them and make sure the right decisions are made. Make sure our voices are heard. It's never mattered more.
Yeah, especially the media landscape and our sources of information, the internet. We need to have really intelligent conversations around what is being spread, how things are being talked about, and how we check those things, put them in perspective, and we don't amplify stuff that doesn't deserve it.
We are out of time, unfortunately. Write to us, otw@2600.com. Please keep listening to WUSB, and we will see you next week. Here's something for Harvard.
demonstrate to them our skills. Albeit they possess the might, nonetheless, we have the will. How we will celebrate our victory, we shall invite the whole team up for tea. How jolly! Hurl that spheroid down the field and fight, fight, fight. Fight fiercely, Harvard! Fight, fight, fight! Impress them with our prowess, do. Oh, fellows, do not let the crimson down. Be of stout heart and true. Come on, chaps, fight for Harvard's glorious name. Won't it be peachy if we win the game? Oh, goody, let's try not to injure them. But fight, 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 let's not be rough, though. Fight, 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 and do fight fiercely. Fight, fight, fight.
Hi, hi, you're listening to WSB 90.1 FM. Currently right now the show is supposed to be off the wall, but I am covering, so this is like technically my third hour of the day, if you really think about it. And I don't really have like a set...